or the Flowers of Progress. Utopia is an island in the South Seas whose inhabitants are ruled by King Paramount I. Our story begins in the gardens of King Paramount's palace, set in a picturesque and luxuriant tropical landscape backed by the sea. Here, in a grove under a cloudless sky, we find a group of young utopian maidens lazing under the palm trees, thoroughly enjoying themselves in a lotus-eating fashion.
Good news. His Majesty's eldest daughter, Princess Sarah, who left our shores 5 years since to go to England, the greatest, the most powerful, the wisest country in the world, has taken a high degree at Girton and is on her way home again. Having achieved a complete mastery over all the elements that have tended to raise that glorious country to her present preeminent position among civilized nations.
Then in a few months, Utopia may hope to be completely anglicized.
Absolutely, and without a doubt.
We are very well as we are. What have we to gain by the great change that is in store for us?
What have we to gain? English institutions, English tastes, and, oh, English fashion.
England has made herself what she is because in that favored land, everyone has to think for himself. Here we have no need to think because our monarch anticipates all our wants and our political opinions are formed for us by the journals to which we subscribe. Oh, think how much more brilliant this dialogue would have been if we had been accustomed to exercise our reflective powers. They say that in England the conversation of the very meanest is a coruscation of impromptu epigram. Stop, stop, I beg.
Oh,
stop it! Oh,
my lord, Tarara, I am surprised at you. Are you not aware that His Majesty, in His despotic acquiescence, with the emphatic wish of His people, has ordered that the Utopian language shall be banished from His court, and that all communications shall henceforth be made in the English tongue?
Yes, I'm perfectly well aware of it, although... Stop. Allow me.
A cracker? Now what's that for?
Why, I've recently been appointed public exploder to His Majesty, and as I'm constitutionally nervous, I must accustom myself by degrees to the startling nature of my duties. Allow me. Thank you. Now, I was about to say that although as public exploder I am next in succession to the throne, I nevertheless do my best to fall in with the royal decree. But when I am overmastered by an indignant sense of overwhelming wrong as I am now, I slip into my native tongue without knowing it. I'm told that in the language of that great and pure nation, England, strong expressions do not exist. Consequently, when I want to let off steam, I have no alternative but to say, lalabaleli malola, lilili kalalali poof.
But what is your grievance?
This. By our constitution, we are governed by a despot, who, although in theory absolute, is in practice nothing of the kind. Being watched day and night by two wise men, whose duty it is, on his very first lapse from political or social propriety, to denounce him to me, the public exploder. And it then becomes my duty to blow up His Majesty with dynamite. Oh, allow me.
Eh? Oh.
Thank you. And as some compensation to my wounded feelings, I reign in his stead.
Yes. After many unhappy experiments in the direction of an ideal republic, it was found that what may be described as a despotism tempered by dynamite provides, on the whole, the most satisfactory description of ruler, an autocrat who dares not abuse his autocratic power.
That's the theory. But in practice, how does it act? Now, do you ever happen to see the Palace Peeper?
Never even heard of the journal.
Well, I'm not surprised, because His Majesty's agents always buy up the whole edition. But I have an aunt in the publishing department, and she has supplied me with a copy. Well, it actually teems with circumstantially convincing details of the king's abominable immoralities. If this high-class journal may be believed, His Majesty is one of the most heliogabalian profligates that ever disgraced an autocratic throne. And do these wise men denounce him to me? Not a bit of it. They wink at his immoralities. Under the circumstances, I really think I am justified in exclaiming lalabaleli malola lilili kalabale poop. Oh, I don't care. I don't care. The occasion demands it. Lalabaleli talala kalabalali kalabalika halalali.
We claim to rank before
the whiteness of humanity
as gifts of head and heart
and heart.
We're wasted on utility.
We're cast to pay a part of great responsibility.
Our duty is to spy, upon our king's illicities.
And keep a watchful eye, on all his eccentricities. If ever a trick he tries, let's say the Zomboscality. At our decree he dies, without the least formality.
Fear no rude rebuff, or newspaper publicity.
Our word is quite enough, the rest is electricity.
A pound of dynamite,
a mite explodes in his auriculars. It's not a pleasant sight, we'll spare you the particulars.
It's false, all men confess, the king needs no admonishing.
We may say it's success, is something quite astonishing.
Our despot is imbued, with virtues quite delectable. He minds his P's and Q's, and keeps himself respectable.
Of a tyrant polite,
he's a paragon quite,
he's as modest and mild
in his ways as a child,
and no one e'er met with an autocrat yet,
so delightfully bent to the least in the land, so bland,
Fantis, you are not in your customary exuberant spirits. What is wrong?
Scafio, I think you once told me that you have never loved.
Never. I've often marveled at the fairy influence which weaves its rosy web about the faculties of the greatest and wisest of our race. But I thank heaven I have never been subjected to its singular fascination. For, Fantis, there is that within me that tells me that when my time does come, the convulsion will be tremendous. When I love, it will be with the accumulated fervor of 66 years. But I have an ideal. A semi-transparent being filled with an inorganic pink jelly. And I have never yet seen the woman who approaches within measurable distance of it. All are opaque.
Keep that ideal firmly before you and love not until you find her. Though but 55, I am an old campaigner in the battlefields of love. And believe me, it is better to be as you are, heart-free and happy, than as I am, eternally racked with doubting agonies. Scafio, the Princess Zara returns from England today.
My poor boy, I see it all.
Oh, Scafio, she is so beautiful. Ah, you smile, for you have never seen her. She sailed for England 3 months before you took office.
Now, tell me, is your affection requited?
I do not know. I am not sure. Sometimes I think it is, and then come these torturing doubts. I feel sure she does not regard me with absolute indifference, for she can never look at me without having to go to bed with a sick headache.
Oh, that is surely something. Oh, come, take heart, boy. Be of good cheer. Marry her, boy, if so your fancy wills, and be sure that love will come.
Then you will assist me in this?
Why, surely, silly one, what have you to fear? We have but to say the word, and her father must consent. Is he not our very slave? Come, take heart. I cannot bear to see you sad.
Now I may hope indeed. Scafio, you have placed me on the very pinnacle of human joy.
Let all your doubts take wing, our influence is great. If paramount our king presume to hesitate, put on the screw and caution him that he will rue disaster grim that must ensue to life and limb should he poo-poo this harmless whim.
This harmless whim,
this harmless whim,
this harmless whim,
this harmless whim. It is, as I say, a harmless whim,
a harmless whim.
Observe this dance which I employ. When I, by chance, go mad with joy. What sentiment does this express? What sentiment does this express?
course it does, of course it does. You'll be in content and happiness. Of course it does, of course it does. It's happiness. Your friendly aid conferred, I need no longer pine. I but to speak the word, and lo, the maid is mine. I do not stoop to be denied, or wish to lose a lovely bride. If to refuse, the king decide, the royal shoes, then woe betide.
Then woe betide.
Then woe betide.
Then woe betide.
Then woe betide. The royal shoes, then woe betide. Then woe betide. This step to use, I condescend. Whene'er I choose to serve a friend, what it implies, now try to guess. What it implies, now try to guess. Typifies unselfishness.
Of course it does, of course it does.
It typifies unselfishness.
Of course it does, of course it does. Unselfishness.
The garden is deserted again, but now comes King Paramount the First, attended by guards and nobles. At the head of the procession are a number of young girls singing and dancing. With the king are his two younger daughters, Nekaya and Kaliba. They are twins, about 15 years old, very modest and demure in their appearance, dress, and manner. With eyes downcast and hands folded, they're in the care of Lady Sophie, their English gouvernante, a lady of mature years and extreme gravity of demeanor, who carries in her hand a lecturer's wand.
Tyrannic will his law, whose rule is paramount for land and sea, a presence of unutterable awe. But though the awe that I inspire must shrivel with imperial fire, all those who it may chance to touch, who just by what I see and hear, it does not seem to interfere with popular enjoyment much. Stupendous when we rouse ourselves to strike, resistless when our tyrant thunder peals. We often wonder what obstruction's like and how a contradicted monarch feels. But as it is our royal whim, a royal sails to set and trim, to suit whatever wind may blow. But Buffett's contradiction deals, and how a thwarted monarch feels, we probably shall never know. My subjects all, it is your wish emphatic that all Utopia shall henceforth be modeled upon that glorious country called Great Britain, to which some add, but others do not, Ireland.
It is!
That being so, as you insist upon it, we have arranged that our two younger daughters, who have been finished by an English lady, a grave and good and gracious English lady, shall daily be exhibited in public, that all may learn what from the English standpoint is looked upon as maidenly perfection. Come hither, daughters.
Thank you. triumphal matrimonial finish. Bold-faced stranger, perfect stranger, needs to well-behaved young lady. He's attractive, young and active, each a little bit afraid. Youth advances at his glances, to the danger they awaken. They repel him as they tell him he is very much mistaken, very, very much mistaken. Though they speak to him politely, please observe their sneering slightly, just to show he's acting vainly. This is virtue saying plainly, go away, young bachelor, we are not what you take us for. When addressed impertinently, English ladies answer gently, go away, young bachelor, we are not what you take us for.
English ladies answer gently, when addressed impertinently, go away, young bachelor, we are not what you take us for.
His intentions, then he mentions something definite to go on. Next recital of his title, hints at settlement and so on. Smiling sweetly, they discreetly ask for further evidences. Thus invited, he delighted, gives the usual references. Don't forget the references. This is business, each is fluttered. When the offer's fairly uttered, which of them has his affection? He declines to make selection. Do they quarrel for his dross? Not a bit of it, they toss.
Requested Scapio and Fantis to be so good as to favor me with an audience this morning. Oh, here they are.
Your Majesty wished to speak with us, I believe. You needn't keep your crown on our account, you know.
I beg your pardon. I always forget that. Odd, the notion of a king not being allowed to wear one of his own crowns in the presence of two of his own subjects.
Yes, bizarre, is it not?
The most quaint, but then, it's a quaint world.
Teems with quiet fun. I often think what a lucky thing it is that you are blessed with such a keen sense of humour.
Well, you know, I find it invaluable. Do what I will, I cannot help looking at the humorous side of things, for properly considered, everything has its humorous side, even the palace peeper. See here,
Another royal scandal by Junius Junior. How long is this to last? By Cynic Senior.
Ribble royalty by Mercury Major.
Where is the public exploder by Mephistopheles Minor? When I reflect that all these outrageous attacks on my morality are written by me at your command, well, it's one of the funniest things that have come within the scope of my experience.
Besides, apart from that, they have a quiet humour of their own, which is simply irresistible.
Not bad, I think. Biting, trenchant sarcasm, the rapier, not the bludgeon, that's my line. But then it's so easy. I'm such a good subject. A bad king, but a good subject. Capital heading for next week's leading article. And then the stinging little paragraphs about our royal goings-on with our royal second housemaid. Delicately sub-acid, are they not?
But the crowning joke is the comic opera that you've written for us, King Tuppence or a Good Deal Less Than Half a Sovereign, in which the celebrated English tenor Mr. Wilkinson burlesques your personal appearance and gives grotesque imitations of your royal peculiarities. It is immense.
Immense.
Yes, that's what I wanted to speak to you about. Now, I've not the least doubt that even that has its humorous side, too, if one could only see it. As a rule, I'm pretty quick at detecting latent humor. But I do confess that I do not quite see where it comes in this particular instance. It's so horribly personal.
Personal? Yes, of course it's personal. But consider the antithetical humor of the situation.
Yes. I don't think I quite grasped that.
No, you surprise me. Why, consider? During the day, thousands tremble at your frown. During the night, from 8 to 11, thousands roar at it. During the day, your most arbitrary pronouncements are received by your subjects with abject submission. During the night, they shout with joy at your most terrible decrees. It's not every monarch who enjoys the privilege of undoing by night all the despotic absurdities he's committed during the day.
Of course, now I see it. Thank you very much. I was sure it had its humorous side, and it was very dull of me not to have seen it before. But as I said just now, it's a quaint world.
Teems with quiet fun.
Yes, properly considered, what a farce life is, to be sure.
First you're born, and I'll be bound you find a dozen strangers round you. Hello, cries the newborn baby, where's my parents, which may they be? Awkward silence, no reply, puzzled baby wonders why. Father rises, bows politely, mother smiles, but not too brightly. Doctor mumbles like a dumb thing, nurse is busy fixing something. Every symptom tends to show you're decidedly de trop.
Ho, 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 ho! Time's teetotum, if you spin it, gives its quotum once a minute. I'll go bail you, hit the nail, and if you fail, the deuce is in it.
Grow up and you discover what it is to be a lover. Some young lady is selected, poor perhaps but well connected, whom you hail for love is blind, as the queen of fairy kind. Though she's plain, perhaps unsightly, makes her face up, laces tightly. In her form your fancy traces all the gifts of all the graces. Rivals none the maiden woo, so you take her and she takes you.
Ho, 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 ho! Joke beginning never ceases, till your evening time releases. On your way you blindly stay, and day by day the joke increases.
10 years later, time progresses, sighs your temper, thins your tresses. Fancy then her chain relaxes, rates are facts and so are taxes. Fairy queen's no longer young, fairy queen has got a tongue. Twins have probably intruded, quite unbidden, just as you did. They're a source of care and trouble, just as you were only double. Comes at last the final stroke. Time has had its little joke.
Ho, 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 ho.
Daily driven, wife has clover, you've driven ne'er in clover. Lastly, when 70 and 10.
When not sure, then the joke is over.
Ho, 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 ho. Daily driven, white as clover. Ilya's driven, daring clover. Last year when he's gone and said. And not till then the joke is over.
It's all very well. I always like to look on the humorous side of things, but I do not think I ought to be required to write libels on my own moral character. Naturally, I see the joke of it. Anybody would. But Zara's coming home today. She's no longer a child, and I confess I should not like her to see my opera, though it's uncommonly well written. And I should be sorry if the palace people got into her hands, although it's certainly smart, very smart indeed. It's almost a pity I have to buy up the whole edition, because it's really too good to be lost. And Lady Sophie, that blameless type of perfect womanhood. Great heavens, what would she say if the second housemaid business happened to meet her pure blue eye?
My monarch is soliloquizing. I will withdraw.
No, Lady Sophie, pray don't go. Now, I'll give you 50 chances, and you won't guess whom I was thinking of.
Alas, sir, I know too well. Ah, oh, King, it's an old, old story, and I'm well nigh weary of it. Be warned in time. From my heart, I pity you, but I am not for you.
But hear what I have to say.
It is useless. Listen. In the course of a long and adventurous career in the principal European courts, it has been revealed to me that I unconsciously exercise a weird and supernatural fascination over all crowned heads. So irresistible is this singular property that there is not a European monarch who has not implored me, with tears in his eyes, to quit his kingdom and take my fatal charms elsewhere. As time was getting on, it occurred to me that by descending several pegs in the scale of respectability, I might qualify Your Majesty for my hand. Actuated by this humane motive, and happening to possess respectability enough for six, I consented to confer respectability enough for four upon your two younger daughters. But although I have, alas, only respectability enough for two left, there is still, as I gather from the public press of this country, a considerable balance in my favor.
May I ask how you came by this?
It was handed to me by the officer who holds the position of public exploder to your Imperial Majesty.
Surely, Lady Sophie, surely you are not so unjust as to place any faith in the irresponsible gabble of the society press.
I read on the authority of Senex Senior that your Majesty was seen dancing with your second housemaid on the oriental platform of the Tivoli Gardens. That is untrue?
Absolutely. Our second housemaid has only one leg.
How do you know that?
A common report, I give you my honor.
It may be so. I further read, and the statement is vouched for by no less an authority than Mephistopheles Minor, that your Majesty indulges in a bath of hot rum punch every morning. I trust I do not lay myself open to the charge of displaying an indelicate curiosity as to the mysteries of the royal dressing room when I ask if there is any foundation for this statement.
None whatever. When our medical adviser exhibits rum punch, it is as a draught, not as a fomentation. As to our bath, our valet plays the garden hose upon us every morning.
Pray spare me these unseemly details. Well, you are a despot. Have you taken steps to slay this scribbler?
Well, no, I have not gone so far as that. After all, it's the poor devil's living, you know.
It is the poor devil's living that surprises me. If this man lies, there is no recognized punishment that is sufficiently terrible for him.
That's precisely it. I am waiting until a punishment is discovered that will exactly meet the enormity of the case. I am in constant communication with the Mikado of Japan, who is a leading authority on such points. And moreover, I have the ground plans and sectional elevations of several capital punishments in my desk at this moment. Oh, Lady Sophie, as you are powerful, be merciful.
your heavenly gifts. Poetical phrase. My brain is turned completely. Observe me now, no monarch I vow was ever so far afflicted.
I'm pleased with that poetical phrase, a heavenly gift. But though you put it neatly, say what you will, these paragraphs still remain uncontradicted. Come crush me, this contemptible worm. A possible term, if he's assailed you wrongly, the rage displayed, which, as you say, has moved your majesty lately.
Though I admit that possible term, contemptible worm appeals to me most strongly. To treat this pest as you suggest would aid my majesty greatly.
The writer lies.
Yes, father, his eyes.
He lives, you say.
In a sort of a way.
Then have him shot.
Decidedly not.
Or crush him flat.
I cannot. Oh, royal Rex, my famous sex,
abhor such conduct shady.
I plead in vain, I never will gain respect for English lady.
Respectable English lady.
Lady Sophie leaves, followed by the king, and now we see his eldest daughter, the Princess Zara. She is surrounded by the entire court and escorted by Captain Fitzbattleaxe and four troopers, all attired in the full uniform of the First Life Guards.
On
the royal yacht, when the waves are white, in a helmet hot and a tunic tight and a great big boot, we defy the storm, for we love recruits and a uniform of well-built troop, and head is cut, and we are in the first lifeguards. The first lifeguards, the first lifeguards. We serve as the escort, first lifeguards.
My beloved daughter, why, how well you look and how lovely you have grown.
My dear father, and my two beautiful little sisters.
Not beautiful, nice looking.
But first, let me present to you the English warrior who commands my escort and who has taken, oh, such care of me during the voyage. Captain Fitzbattleaxe.
First lifeguard, first lifeguard. When the tempest rose and the ship went south, do you suppose you're ill?
No! Sir, you come from a country where every virtue flourishes. We trust that you will not criticize too severely such shortcomings as you may detect in our semi-barbarous society.
Sir, I have eyes for nothing but the blameless and the beautiful.
We thank you. He is really very polite.
Oh.
Lady Sophie, do not leave us.
Sir, your children are young and so far innocent. If they are to remain so, it is necessary that they be at once removed from the contamination of their present disgraceful surroundings.
Captain Fitzbattleaxe.
Sir!
Your troopers appear to be receiving a troublesome amount of attention from those young ladies. I know how strict you English soldiers are, and I should be extremely distressed if anything occurred to shock their puritanical British sensitiveness.
I don't think there's any chance of that.
You think not? They won't be offended.
Oh, no, they're quite hardened to it. They get a good deal of that sort of thing, standing sentry at the Horse Guards.
It's English, is it?
It's particularly English.
Then, of course, it's all right. Pray proceed, ladies. It's particularly English. Come, my daughter, for we have much to say to each other.
Farewell, Captain Fitzbattleaxe. I cannot thank you too emphatically for the devoted care with which you have watched over me during our long and eventful voyage.
Oh, gallant soldier, brave and true, intent in field and journey, I grieve to have occasion to so very long a journey.
When a soldier seeks you token pledge in charge of youth and beauty, then pleasure merely masquerades as regimental duty.
Scafio, is she not beautiful? Can you wonder that I love her so passionately?
No, she is extraordinarily, miraculously lovely. Good heavens, what a singularly beautiful girl.
I knew you would say so.
What exquisite charm of manner. What surprising delicacy of gesture. Why, she's a goddess, a very goddess.
Yes, she is an attractive girl.
Attractive? Why, you must be blind. She's entrancing, enthralling, intoxicating. God bless my heart. What's the matter with me?
Yes, but you promised to help me to get her father's consent, you know.
Promised? Yes, but the convulsion has come, my good boy. It is she, my ideal.
Oh.
Why, what's this? Oh, Francis, Francis, stop me. I'm going mad. Mad with the love of her.
Scafio, compose yourself, I beg. Mm. The girl is perfectly opaque. Besides, remember, each of us is helpless without the other. Mm. You can't succeed without my consent, you know.
And you dare to threaten? Oh, ungrateful. When you came to me, palsied with love for this girl and implored my assistance, did I not unhesitatingly promise it? And this is the return you make? Out of my sight, ingrate.
Dear me, Captain Fitzbattleaxe. I'm afraid we are interrupting a tete-a-tete.
Oh, no. You come very appropriately. To be brief, we love you, this man and I, madly, passionately.
Sir.
And we don't know how we're to settle, which of us is to marry you.
Dear Captain Fitzbattleaxe, what is to be done?
Leave it to me. I'll manage it. It is a common situation. Why not settle it in the English fashion?
The English fashion? What is that?
It's very simple. In England, when two gentlemen are in love with the same lady, and until it is settled which gentleman is to blow out the brains of the other, it is provided by the Rival Admirers Clauses Consolidation Act that the lady shall be entrusted to an officer of Household Cavalry Stakeholder, who is bound to hand over to the survivor, on the Tontine principle, in good condition of substantial and decorative repair.
That seems very reasonable. What do you say? Shall we entrust her to this officer of Household Cavalry? Will give us time.
Sir, I'm not at present in a condition to think it out coolly, but if he is an officer of Household Cavalry, and if the princess consents...
Alas, dear sirs, I have no alternative under the Rivals Admirers Clauses Consolidation Act.
Good. Then that's settled.
It's understood, I think, around that by the English custom bound, I hold the lady safe and sound in trust for either rival. Until you clearly testify by sword or pistol by and by which gentleman prefers to die and which prefers survival.
It's clearly understood around what stands your biggest quest about. We hold the lady's safe and sound in trust for the rival. Until we clearly testify by sword or pistol by and by which gentleman survival.
If I should die and he should live, to you without reserve I give her heart so young and sensitive and all her predilections. If he should live and I should die, I see no kind of reason why you should not, if you wish it, try to gain her young affection. If I should die and I should live, to this young officer I give her heart, I give her sensitive and her predilections. If you should live and I should die, and he should die, and he should try to win her young affections. If I should die and you should live, to this young officer I give her heart, I give her sense, give her heart, predilections. If you should live and I should die, I see no kind of reason why you should not give your sense, give your sense, try to gain her young affections.
Neatly planned intention, oh happy intervention, oh well constructed plot, oh well constructed plot. The stage's title part, to loving heart infusion, their wisdom's a delusion, and learning's left them not, and learning's first them not.
Until quite plain is their intent, the sage's brain I represent. Now please infer that nothing low, your henceforth as it were engaged to marry both. Then take it that I represent the two. On that hypothesis, what would you do?
What would I do? What would I do?
There's no such case as perfect rest. So some petty blight asserts its sway. Some crumpled rose leaf blood is always in the way.
It's not a face upon the earth. I'm flushing face. I'm
my daughter, at last we are alone together.
Yes, and I'm glad we are, for I want to speak to you very seriously. Do you know this paper?
Where in the world did you get this from?
It was given to me by Lady Sophie, my sister's governess.
Lady Sophie is an angel, but I do sometimes wish she'd mind her own business. It's rather humorous.
I see nothing humorous in it. I only see that you, the despotic king of this country, are made the subject of the most scandalous insinuations. Why do you permit these things?
Well, they appeal to my sense of humour. It's the only really comic paper in Utopia, and I wouldn't be without it for the world.
If it had any literary merit, I could understand it.
Oh, it has literary merit. Oh, distinctly, it has literary merit.
My dear father, it's mere ungrammatical twaddle.
Oh, it's not ungrammatical. I can't allow that. Unpleasantly personal, perhaps, but written with an epigrammatical point that is very rare nowadays. Very rare indeed.
Why do they represent you with such a big nose?
Yes, it is a big one. Why, the fact is that in the cartoons of a comic paper, the size of your nose always varies inversely as the square of your popularity. It's the rule.
Then you must be at a tremendous discount just now.
Well, I think I am.
I see a notice of a new piece called King Tuppence, in which an English tenor has the audacity to personate you on a public stage. I can only say that I'm surprised that any English tenor should lend himself to such degrading personalities.
Oh, he's not really English, as it happens. He's a utopian, but he calls himself English.
Calls himself English?
Yes, bless you, they wouldn't listen to any tenor who didn't call himself English.
And you permit this insolent buffoon to caricature you in a pointless burlesque. Oh, my dear father, if you were a free agent, you would never permit these outrages.
Sarah, I admit I am not altogether a free agent. I am controlled. Nominally a despot, I am, between ourselves, the helpless tool of two unscrupulous wise men who insist on my falling in with all their wishes and threaten to denounce me for immediate explosion if I remonstrate.
My poor father. Now listen to me. With a view to remodeling the political and social institutions of Utopia, I have brought with me six representatives of the principal causes that have tended to make England the powerful, happy, and blameless country which the consensus of European civilization has declared it to be. Place yourself unreservedly in the hands of these gentlemen, and they will reorganize your country on a footing that will enable you to defy your persecutors. They are all now washing their hands after their journey. Shall I introduce them?
My dear Sarah, how can I thank you? I will consent to anything that will release me from the abominable tyranny of these two men. What ho! Without there! Summon my court without an instant's delay!
My beloved daughter most thoughtfully has brought with her from England the types of all the causes that have made the great and glorious country what it is.
Oh, joy and love it!
I want to ask!
What does this mean?
What does it mean?
What does it mean?
What does it mean?
Attend to me! Utopian populace, be thought courtly grace. Yet, when compared with Britain's glorious race, a little bitter than all those barbarians.
What does it mean? What does it mean?
Subject I can scout and demonstrate beyond all possibility of doubt that whether you're an honest man or whether you're a thief depends on who solicitor has given me my brief.
Yes, 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 that whether you're an honest man or whether you're a thief depends on who solicitor has given you his brief. Thank you.
to speculate as if the prize of grand financial haven. Time was when to a company, but now it must be seven.
Yes, yes, yes. Time was when to a company, but now it must be seven. Stupendous loans to foreign thrones I've largely advocated. In ginger pumps and peppermint drops I freely speculated. Then mines of gold of wealth untold successfully I floated. And sudden falls in apple stores occasionally quoted. And soon or late I always call for stock exchange quotation. No schemes too great and none too small for a perfect fiction.
And lastly I present great Britain's proudest boast, who from the blows of foreign foes protect her seagull's coast. And if you ask him in respectful tone, he'll show you how you may protect your own.
I'm Captain Corcoran, KCB. I'll teach you how we rule the sea and terrify the simple Gaul, and how the Saxon and the Celt their Europe's shaking blows have dealt with Maxim gun and Nordenfelt, or will when the occasion calls. If sailor-like you'd play your cards and bend your sails and lower your yards and step your mast, you'll never want a more. Though we're no longer hearts of oak, yet we can steer and we can stoke, and thanks to coal and thanks to coke, we never run a ship ashore.
What, never?
No, never.
What, never?
Well, hardly ever.
Hardly ever run a ship ashore. Then, if we take the pitches of the town, we'll never run a ship ashore. If we take the pitches of all,
sluggish brains.
Widen your thoroughfares and flush your drains.
Utopia's much too big for one small head. I'll float it as a company limited.
A company limited, what may that be? The term I rather think is new to me.
A company limited, what may that be?
Give us some kind of clue. What's he mean? What's he mean? What's he going to do?
Some seven men form an association. If
possible, all peers and baronets. They start off with a public declaration to what extent they mean to pay their debts. That's called their capital. If they are wary, they will not quote it at a sum immense. The figure's immaterial. It may vary from 18 billion down to 18 pence. I should put it rather low. The good sense of doing so will be evident at once to any debtor when it's left to you to say what amount you mean to pay. Why, the lower you can put it at, the better.
When it's left to you to say what amount you mean to pay, why, the lower you can put it at, the better.
They then proceed to trade with all who trust them, quite irrespective of their capital. It's shady, but it's sanctified by custom. Bank, railway, loan, or Panama Canal, you can't embark on trading too tremendous. It's strictly fair and based on common sense. If you succeed, your profits are stupendous. And if you fail, pop goes your 18 pence. Make the money spin a spin, for you only stand to win, and you'll never with dishonesty be twitted. For nobody can know to a million or so to what extent your capital's committed.
For nobody can know to a million or so to what extent your capital's committed.
If you come to grief and creditors are craving, for nothing that is planned by mortal head is certain in this vale of sorrow, saving that one's liability is limited. Do you suppose that signifies perdition? If so, you're but a monetary dunce. You merely file a winding up petition and start another company at once. Though a Rothschild you may be, in your own capacity as a company you've come to utter sorrow. But the liquidators say, never mind, you needn't pay. So you start another company tomorrow.
But the liquidators say, never mind, you needn't pay. So you start another company tomorrow.
At first sight, it strikes us as dishonest. But if it's good enough for virtuous England, the first commercial country in the world, it's good enough for us.
You'd best take care, please recollect, we have not been consulted.
And do I understand you that Great Britain, upon this joint stock principle, is governed?
We haven't come to that exactly, but we're tending rapidly in that direction. The date's not distant.
We will be before you. We'll go down to posterity, renowned as the first sovereign in Christendom, who registered his crown and country under the Joint Stock Companies Act of 62.
Henceforward, our affinity, we fame ourselves with ink. We'll go down to posterity, our sovereign's all the pink.
In view the methamenity, our wishes thus to think. You'll go down to posterity, much earlier than you think.
You go up to posterity, if I inflict the blow.
You go down to posterity, we think we ought to know.
You go up, blown up with dynamite.
You go up, of course, he will. You're right, you're right.
Ha, 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 ha.